So if you hand a kid a map of the world,
Right.
right, and you give the thick black marker and just tell them, hey, draw a single straight line dividing the West from the East, they'll probably strike a line right down the middle of Eurasia.
Yeah.
It just, I mean, it feels intuitive to us.
Yeah.
We like things to be categorized, you know, to be neatly boxed up.
Oh, absolutely. But the problem is, we treat that arbitrary line as if it's been like etched into the bedrock of the earth since the dawn of time. We assume that everything on one side shares this, well, this fundamental genetic essence that makes it entirely different from everything on the other side.
Right. But the moment you actually look at the historical landscape, that thick black marker just dries up because we're looking at a global history that is wonderfully and honestly intensely messy. So today's deep dive is really about giving you the cheat code to see right through these historical cliches.
Yeah, we're pulling apart this massive, incredibly fascinating source text today, the West and the East in world history.
Exactly. And our mission here is to totally dismantle that invisible line on the map. We want to understand why the modern world looks the way it does without, you know, falling back on this lazy myth of civilizational destiny.
Right, because the core premise we're pulling from this text is that the global divergence we see today, it wasn't written in the stars. It was a highly contingent, almost accidental combination of things. You know, institutions, energy, empire, and global resources just sort of colliding at the exact right moment.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because before we can even look at the history of these regions, we have to deal with the labels themselves, right? I mean, categorizing the world into East and West is like trying to draw a hard line through a bowl of soup. The ingredients have always been swirling together in these overlapping Venn diagrams.
That is a perfect analogy because the labels East and West, they are entirely made up. They're concepts that have morphed and, well, in many cases, they've been actively weaponized over centuries.
Weaponized how? Like, where do these terms actually start?
Well, if we rewind all the way back to ancient Greek writers like Herodotus, he used Europe and Asia simply as geographical markers during the Greco-Persian conflicts. It wasn't some grand sweeping theory of two opposing civilizations.
Because the Greek world itself was super fragmented, right?
Exactly. They were too busy fighting rival city-states, building monarchies, and trading all across the Mediterranean. And then later on, the Roman Empire, they didn't view themselves as the center of a West. Their entire worldview was centered around the Mediterranean Sea, looking inward, not pushing outward against an Eastern other.
So when does this idea of the West as a unified identity actually become a thing?
It started to take shape much later. Mostly when Latin Christendom needed a way to distinguish itself from Orthodox Byzantium and also from the rising Islamic caliphates. And from there, the definition just kept shifting.
Yeah, and you jump forward to the Cold War, and suddenly the West just means the United States and its strategic allies. I mean, it stopped being a historical or geographic region entirely. It just morphed into a political and economic bloc.
Which leaves us with the East, a label that is, I mean, arguably even less coherent. During the age of European imperialism in the 19th century, academics created this incredibly broad, sweeping classification for basically everything else.
And this is where Edward Said's critique of Orientalism becomes so vital for us to understand.
Definitely. Said pointed out that European scholarship was taking this massive, sprawling diversity of North Africa, the Middle East, South Asia, and East Asia, and just compressing it all, smashing it into a single static concept they called the Orient.
Right, but it wasn't just lazy map making, it was a very deliberate tool of administration. Because if you can define an entire hemisphere as, I don't know, exotic, irrational, or perpetually stuck in the past, it becomes incredibly easy to justify marching in to administer and dominate it.
Yeah, you basically paint yourself as the rational, modern adult taking care of the backward child. Now, the text notes we should qualify this slightly because European scholarship wasn't entirely a monolith, and local scholars often participated in shaping this knowledge too.
Right, it wasn't just a one-way street.
Exactly. But the underlying dynamic is undeniable. The binary was an instrument of power. In reality, instead of a solid line, history looks more like those massive overlapping Venn diagrams you mentioned.
The bowl of soup.
The bowl of soup, the source points out these incredible overlapping zones. Like you have the Mediterranean linking Southern Europe, North Africa, and the Levant.
And then there's this massive steppe corridor, right, stretching from Hungary all the way across to Mongolia, which is constantly moving people and ideas back and forth.
Yes, and you have a Persianate zone influencing culture and language from Iran deep into South Asia, and a sinosphere connecting China, Korea, Japan, and Vietnam. The borders were entirely permeable. There was no hard line.
Okay, I get that the labels are messy and the borders were fluid, but I keep getting stuck on one major thing here. Wait, if Europe did industrialize and colonize first, isn't it just easier to say their system was inherently better designed for it? Why not call it destiny?
What's fascinating here is that this exact line of thinking is what historians call the teleology trap. Teleology is basically a fancy academic way of saying reading history backward.
Oh.
When you know how the story ends with European global dominance in the 19th and 20th centuries, you just assume every single step taken over the previous 2,000 years was purposefully leading to that exact conclusion. It confuses a temporary advantage in power with a permanent inherent superiority.
I see. So you look at a smoke belching factory in London in 1850 and just assume the Romans must have been doing something uniquely brilliant in 50 BC to guarantee that factory would exist.
Precisely the trap. And historians have spent a really long time trying to build grand theories to explain this without falling into teleology. And honestly, many failed.
Like who?
Well, take Karl Marx. He came up with this vague concept he called the Asiatic mode of production. He tried to argue that because Asian societies relied on massive, large-scale irrigation works, they naturally required oppressive, centralized states to manage the water and collect taxes.
Which he thought led to this idea of enduring Eastern despotism.
Exactly. But the text totally tears that apart, because Asian societies actually had vibrant private property, complex markets, and totally varied political systems. Marx basically took a tiny, limited observation and tried to force it into a universal law of nature.
And then jumping to the mid-20th century, you get modernization theory, right?
Yeah.
Which proposed this really neat, comforting sequence. It said that traditional agrarian societies will just naturally evolve into urban, industrial, secular democracies.
Right. It assumed economic growth automatically churns out liberal democracy. It treated the Western path as the default human norm.
Which, just looking at the geopolitical landscape today, we know is deeply flawed. I mean, there are plenty of authoritarian states with booming, hyper-advanced capitalist economies right now.
Exactly. Modernization theory completely undervalued the role of empire, coercion, and local culture. So to counter this, you get thinkers like Emanuel Wallerstein, who developed world systems analysis. He looked at it relationally.
Meaning he looked at how the different regions interacted rather than just in isolation.
Yes. Wallerstein argued that European development didn't happen in a vacuum. It fundamentally depended on extracting wealth from a periphery. They needed the resources and coerced labor of other continents to fuel their own rise.
So the core gets rich by actively keeping the periphery poor. But the text suggests even that model has flaws, right? Like, it can sometimes strip away the agency and the unique cultural innovations of the people actually living in those extracted regions.
Yeah, it can make them seem like passive victims rather than active players. Which brings us to a much more nuanced framework, Kenneth Pomerantz and the Great Divergence Debate.
Oh, this is a big one.
It is. Pomerantz makes the case that Europe's eventual economic dominance wasn't about deep-seated cultural superiority at all. It relied on incredibly late, highly contingent factors. Basically, two massive strokes of luck.
Okay, what was the first one?
Coal. Just as Europe was running out of wood for fuel and facing a really severe energy bottleneck, they found easily accessible coal right near their population centers, especially in Britain.
And the second stroke of luck was the Americas.
Right. What Pomerantz famously calls ghost acres. Instead of having to use their own limited European land to grow food and fiber to sustain a growing industrial workforce, they essentially used the Americas as a massive, free ecological backyard.
Wow, ghost acres. That's a haunting term.
It is. They extracted calories and raw materials using slave labor, which allowed them to escape their own environmental limits at the exact right historical moment.
Which totally shifts the perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It wasn't some inevitable cultural destiny. It was just coal and colonies. And that maps perfectly onto S.N. Eisenstadt's concept in the text, the idea of multiple modernities.
Exactly. The idea here is that modernity isn't just one single destination that looks exactly like a Western liberal democracy. Societies can adopt modern institutions like mass production or bureaucracy or global trade and run them through their own cultural software.
Right. They create totally different highly effective versions of the modern world. So what does this all mean? I mean, to really prove that this wasn't destiny, we have to rewind, right? We have to look at the ancient foundations.
We do. And when we do, we find that both ends of Eurasia produced these incredibly diverse political toolkits.
Think of the ancient world as a massive buffet of governance. You have a tray of codified law over here, a platter of sacred kingship there, maybe some centralized bureaucracy on the side. Later civilizations didn't inherit a fixed Western or Eastern set menu. They walked up and put together their own plates based on what they needed to survive. Nobody ordered the exact same meal.
I love the buffet analogy. Let's look at the Greek tray at that buffet. The popular narrative is that Athens invented democracy, which translates directly to Western liberty. But the text is quick to remind us that Athenian democracy completely excluded women, shut out resident foreigners, and depended on a massive population of enslaved people to actually function.
Right. Athens was just one model. Mm-hmm. You also had Sparta's intensely militarized oligarchy and Macedon's expansionist monarchy.
Exactly. Greek philosophy was undoubtedly brilliant, but it coexisted comfortably with severe patriarchy and endless warfare. It wasn't this pure, unblemished blueprint for modern human rights.
And if we slide over to the east on that buffet, ancient China wasn't just sitting there practicing static despotism. During the period from the Zhou to the Qinan Han dynasties, they were developing a profoundly complex synthesis of ideas.
They really were. You had Confucian thinkers arguing for a moral hierarchy, where a ruler's legitimacy depended on humane rule and caring for the people. But then you also had Taoist philosophy actively challenging that kind of coercive ambition.
Right. Taoism was celebrating a more natural kind of hands-off approach to power.
And we absolutely can't forget the legalists. Legalist thinkers didn't care about moral philosophy at all. They stressed strict administrative technique, clear rewards and punishments, and completely impersonal standards.
So when the Qin dynasty unified China and the Han dynasty later consolidated it, they didn't just pick one of these philosophies off the tray. They blended them. They took the strict, impersonal, bureaucratic machinery of the legalists and wrapped it in the moral, stabilizing ideology of Confucianism.
Which is highly sophisticated statecraft. It's not blind tyranny. It's a very calculated, enduring system of management. And then you look at India, which offers a whole other level of diversity.
Oh, yeah. You have the Varna and Jati systems, what we often call the caste system, organizing social status and labor. But simultaneously, you have Buddhism emerging and offering a radical egalitarian critique of that exact ritual status.
And then you look at the Mauryan Empire, where the Emperor Ashoka is carving edicts into stone pillars all across the subcontinent. He's broadcasting a message of moral kingship, nonviolence, and universal ethics.
Which brings us to the Achaemenid Persian Empire. They were figuring out how to govern a vast, totally pluralistic territory. They didn't force everyone to be Persian. They used layered sovereignty.
Right. They accommodated local religions and elites as long as they paid tribute and remained loyal. And this leads to a really fascinating comparison in the source text, Rome versus Han China.
Because they were both massive territorial empires at roughly the same time.
Exactly. Both built incredible road systems, managed complex taxation, and established durable legal orders. But their underlying foundations were totally different. Rome operated by delegating a tremendous amount of power to local municipal elites.
So they relied on legal pluralism, letting local cities manage their own affairs under the broader Roman umbrella.
Yes. Whereas the Han dynasty repeatedly reunified around the ideal of a centralized civil bureaucracy. They wanted magistrates sent directly from the capital managing the provinces and not local warlords or municipal elites.
And this difference in the toolkit is why when the Western Roman Empire eventually collapsed, it fractured permanently.
Yep.
The local municipal structures just decoupled and became their own independent kingdoms.
Mm-hmm.
The overarching Roman state was gone for good.
But when Chinese dynasties fell, the blueprint for that centralized administrative ideal remained deeply ingrained in the culture. The next dynasty would just dust off the blueprint and rebuild the centralized state.
So if the ancient world provided these distinct toolkits, the medieval period is where the paths they chose begin to cross and diverge in incredibly surprising ways. We have to completely throw out the traditional script of the Dark Ages here.
Oh, absolutely. Because while Latin Christendom is fracturing into this messy, chaotic mosaic of competing kingdoms, isolated monasteries, and walled cities. The East is absolutely booming. The contrast is staggering.
Walk us through that contrast. What's happening in the Islamic world?
Well, starting in the 7th and 8th centuries, the Islamic world generated a vast, highly interconnected commercial and scholarly zone that stretched from Spain all the way to Central Asia. Arabic basically became the lingua franca for science, law, mathematics, and trade.
So cities like Baghdad and Cordoba were these cosmopolitan global centers. They were translating ancient Greek texts, inventing algebra, advancing medicine, all while Western Europe was highly localized and largely rural.
Exactly. And the scale of Tang and Song China is just hard to wrap your head around. The economic explosion there during the Song era sees the mass commercialization of agriculture, the invention of paper money, the widespread use of woodblock printing,
and massive maritime trade networks. But crucially, they also drastically expand the civil service examination system.
Yes. That examination system is a massive institutional shift. Instead of letting a hereditary aristocracy run the government just because of who their parents were, the Chinese state began recruiting a massive scholar official class based on ruling literary exams.
It created a merit-based bureaucracy that tied the ambition of local elites directly to the survival of the central state. It's brilliant. But let's pivot back to Europe for a second, where political power is incredibly dispersed. And this is vital for you to understand. Power wasn't dispersed because medieval Europeans had some enlightened appreciation for modern liberty.
No, not at all. Power was dispersed because European rulers were weak. They completely lacked the administrative reach, the taxation power, or the standing armies of a Tang emperor or an Islamic caliph. Because they were so weak, they had to constantly negotiate and bargain just to survive.
Bargaining with nobles, with the clergy, with wealthy merchants in the towns?
This raises an important question, right? How does that weakness actually lead to institutional strength later on? A perfect example of this friction from the source text is the investiture controversy.
Ah, right. Between Pope Gregory VII and Emperor Henry V.
Exactly. It was a massive, drawn-out conflict over who had the right to appoint church officials. Modern observers often misread this as an early attempt at the separation of church and state. But the text argues it was actually the birth of durable jurisdictional competition.
Meaning you have two massive authorities, the church and the crown, constantly fighting for dominance, and neither is strong enough to completely crush the other.
Right. And this friction between popes, kings, and eventually the rising guilds and parliaments accidentally planted the seeds for representative bodies and contractual law. Because no single authority could dominate, they were forced to create legal frameworks to manage their disputes.
Meanwhile, in the East, immense wealth and massive agrarian surpluses funded these highly centralized administrative states. They were so powerful, they simply didn't need to bargain with their subjects in the same way. We usually think of the European Middle Ages as backwards, but here, the East is the booming, advanced center of the world, while Europe's weakness actually forced it to innovate.
It's a huge paradigm shift. Oh, and we cannot leave the Middle Ages without talking about the Mongols. The Mongol conquests were undeniably violent and disruptive, but they also created an unprecedented trans-Eurasian network. They unified that steppe corridor we talked about earlier.
Which represents the ultimate double-edged sword of global integration, doesn't it?
It really does, because the Mongols pacified and protected the trade routes, which allowed vital knowledge, technologies like gunpowder and trade goods, to flow freely across Eurasia. But that exact same integration provided the superhighway for the Black Death to spread from Asia into the Middle East and Europe, which obviously devastated populations everywhere.
Okay, so we have the ancient toolkits, we have the medieval fragmentation in the West, and massive integration in the East. Now we arrive at the crucial pivot point, the early modern period, roughly 1450 to 1800. If Europe was so fractured, how did they eventually tip the global balance of power?
We have to start by recognizing that the major Islamic states of this era, the Ottoman, Safavid, and Mughal empires, were incredibly formidable. They are sometimes dismissively called gunpowder empires, but they were highly successful, sophisticated states.
Right. The Ottomans built an incredible provincial administration that managed diverse populations across three continents.
And the Mughals ruled over a deeply pluralistic, religiously diverse South Asia by using a system of negotiated sovereignty with local elites. They were not failed copies of Europe. They were doing their own thing very successfully.
And looking at East Asia, King China is managing an absolutely massive internal commercial economy while actively expanding its frontiers. And over in Japan, the Tokugawa shogunate unifies the country and implements this brilliant system of control called alternate attendance.
The mechanism of alternate attendance is so fascinating. Basically, to prevent the regional lords, the daimyo, from rebelling, the shogun forced them to march to the capital, Edo, every other year. They had to maintain lavish residences there.
And when they returned to their home provinces, they had to leave their wives and children behind in Edo as hostages.
Exactly. It severely drained the daimyo's wealth on travel and dual residences, ensuring they could never afford to fund an uprising. It was just a masterclass in bureaucratic control.
So the great Eurasian land empires are wealthy and stable. But the major shift happens out on the oceans. European maritime expansion totally changed the scale of global connection. And, as the text points out, it wasn't a story of peaceful free trade. It was fundamentally asymmetrical.
Right. European powers didn't invent the Indian Ocean trade networks. Those had been thriving for centuries. The Europeans simply inserted themselves into those networks using heavy naval firepower and armed chartered companies.
And they turbocharged this expansion using the Atlantic system we touched on earlier with Pomeranz. They extracted unimaginable wealth through Atlantic slavery, brutal plantation production, and the mining of American silver. They were essentially strip mining the globe to build asymmetrical power back home.
Yes. And as this global shift accelerated, we also see deep, persistent institutional differences taking root in the everyday lives of ordinary people. The text highlights a major divergence in family and household structures here. In Northwestern Europe, you start to see a dominant pattern of later marriage ages and relatively small nuclear households.
Which is a stark contrast to the extended kin networks, the massive lineages and joint households that were much more common across Asia and the Middle East, which of course provided their own forms of social safety nets and economic pooling.
Exactly. And this difference in family structure trickles all the way down into property rights and gender dynamics.
Here's where it gets really interesting. We talk endlessly about Western liberty, but the text points out that this liberty didn't exactly apply to a European woman's bank account. European law relied heavily on a concept called coverture.
Coverture basically meant that when a woman got married, her legal identity was entirely subsumed by her husband.
She lost the independent right to own property, sign contracts, or control her own wages. Her legal self was just erased. Meanwhile, Islamic jurisprudence explicitly recognized a woman's independent legal identity. Under Islamic law, women retain the right to own property, manage their own wealth, and inherit.
Now, to be clear, those Islamic inheritance laws usually mandated unequal shares compared to men, but it was still a constitutionally recognized legal right to property and financial independence that European women simply lacked for centuries.
It completely shatters that neat, simplistic narrative of a progressively free West and a perpetually oppressed East.
Yeah.
The reality on the ground was far more complicated, depending entirely on who you were and what aspect of life we're examining.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the principal difference the text highlights is not a moral binary of freedom versus despotism. It's a structural institutional difference. Parts of Europe accidentally developed this unusually persistent, messy competition among corporate bodies, states, churches, nobles, independent cities, and guilds. They were constantly checking each other's power. East Asian empires, conversely, successfully organized their elite classes and structured ambition through highly centralized dynastic institutions and rigorous civil bureaucracy.
So, two totally different, highly effective ways of organizing human society, born from totally different historical pressures, which brings us to the ultimate takeaway of our deep dive into the West and the East in world history. The profound truth here is that there is no civilizational monopoly on liberty, on community, on rationality, or on coercion. We are all living in hybrids.
Absolutely. If you live in the United States, Europe, China, Korea, Japan, India, or the Middle East today, your society is not a pure distillation of ancient philosophy. It is a complex, overlapping mix of inherited ancient institutions, the scars and legacies of colonialism, the pressures of modern technology, and the realities of global capitalism.
So the next time you hear a politician giving a speech, or some pundit on a talk show waving their hands and talking about Western destiny or Eastern mindsets, you now have the historical receipts. You know it is a gross oversimplification.
You understand the overlapping Venn diagrams of geography. You know about the contingent luck of coal deposits and ghost acres. And you see how different cultures walked up to the ancient buffet of statecraft and built entirely different plates.
You can see right through that artificial black line drawn on the map.
It's an empowering way to view history, really. It removes the inevitability and replaces it with human agency and environmental reality.
Which leaves us with one final lingering thought to chew on. For the last two millennia, geography, oceans, mountains, and physical borders were the canvas we used to define the East and the West. The physical world forced those boundaries on us. But what happens now?
That is the big question.
We were living in a digital age, surrounded by borderless AI networks and instantaneous globalized information. Will these technologies create entirely new, non-geographic civilizational zones? 50 years from now, when someone hands a kid a thick black marker to divide the world, maybe the Great Divide won't be East versus West at all. Maybe the new dividing line will be the cloud versus the earth. Think about that the next time you look at a map. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.